as we start today, let me first of all, let me check and say, can you all hear me okay?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, I'm going to do my very best. I'm going to stay very stationary here. I'm at the Bellagio Hotel in Las Vegas, and we're going to test their internet capabilities here. just to start with, in terms of, I just want to talk for just a moment about confidentiality, is that we are going to record today's presentation, and owing to the fact that my own style is to be a little bit more interactive, probably just by nature. In fact, let me just lay out kind of the format, and then we'll talk about confidentiality. I'll be presenting for just a few minutes today about some reflections on the shadow, and then tie that into forgiveness practice, including a meditation, all from kind of informed by the Buddhist traditions. So we'll be doing an exercise here together today. And then after that, I'd like to open it up. I can imagine that'll be the first 30 or 40 minutes between the little presentation of thoughts about shadow and then our meditation. And then after that, I really want to open it up. But in order to do that, we need to be able to know what we want to say and not say. Since it's going to be recorded, and so other students perhaps will be able to listen to this, I want to make sure that you know before going in that if you share something, I'll be sharing things personally for sure, but if you share something, just to be aware of that so that you can make your own choice. I think it's good to be informed, and then you can at what level you want to share. Over the years, teaching psychologists use role plays with students and to share in class. Recommend that students share whatever they're comfortable to share with a dyad partner, for example, or with a larger class, and it's in that spirit. So that's a little kind of prologue there. And with that, you can kind of decide whatever level you're comfortable. Since we're talking about shadow, it invites conversation about shadow, and I'd like you to feel as comfortable as possible. Okay, so
Bob,
with that, let's dive in.
Could
yes.
I just add quickly, Bob, this is Heidi, that if anyone does blurt out something they wish they hadn't, you do have the option to contact me and we can just edit it out. So there's that.
Thanks for reminding.
Yeah, that's fine.
That way we're covered. I'm sure I'll be blurting out a lot of things. So thank you, Heidi. That's great.
Blurt away.
Okay, thank you. So we have Lisa, Sally, Victoria, Heidi, and Bob here today, and I'm in hopes that Hamlet may join us too. So we'll see. We'll see if he's able to join. The topic for today is a continuation of previous conversations, including with Guy and John here recently, looking at integral shadow work. And what I'll be sharing are just some of my own reflections, as well as my own experience and even current practice. Around working with the shadow, I think from an integrally informed perspective for sure, and as I mentioned earlier, specifically want to look at Buddhist forgiveness practice as part of a kind of a mindfulness regimen. That's generally the topic. Let me start by just a few words about the shadow. I want to talk more personally if I can. And I invite you all to kind of reflect internally on your own experience, and then at the end when we're just kind of open up the dialogue for question and answer. After the meditation, you're very welcome to share anything that comes up in the next few minutes for you. I'm really sharing this as in the spirit of provoking your own association. So I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, back in the 50s and 60s, and as it turns out, I grew up in a very politically active family. My mother's family were all involved in politics. And I still have memories of sitting on the back porch and listening to the Speaker of the House at that point was Jim Wright. He was a friend of the family. He was from Weatherford, just up the road from where my family lived. And it was my mom's family. In fact, it was her mother who was kind of the matriarch. She would preside over these discussions. I had two uncles that were in Washington, D.C., under the Kennedy and LBJ administration. And so there was all this talk about politics, kind of liberal Southern Democrat politics that I grew up in. over the years, I've told people when they ask me about my political persuasions, I've said, I think I'm genetically Democrat, just growing up in that environment. I don't think I had much choice otherwise. But one of the things that occurred to me is one of my earliest memories, and it would probably be in my just the beginnings of this in my grade school years, preteen for sure, is that with all the talk about politics and really, I think, very respectable ethics around economic policies, and this is right in the height of the civil rights era. My mom was an ardent feminist and just really, and also an ardent environmentalist. We were lifelong members of the Sierra Club. All of this was the content of the conversations around the dinner table and afterwards. And every Sunday was spent in these kinds of conversations. But it was day in, day out. But I had this feeling inside that something was off. And how I understood it then is probably different than how I would articulate it now, but it's the same feeling, is that with all of this talk about politics and making good decisions at a personal and a societal level, I was so aware of the shadow side, to put it in this language now, of my own family and of the larger extended family's psyche. There was a lot of unprocessed emotional stuff. There were abuses of every kind of shape and size, even as the political conversations continued on. So it was my first kind of extended experience of there being some kind of fly in the ointment, which I later came to identify as, in the language of Carl Jung, as the shadow. As fate would have it, my rebellion from my family of origin, because my family was so kind of progressive politically and so on, my rebellion was to become a conservative Christian. both my parents were bitterly disappointed with that decision. It was what did we do wrong? And so I got very involved. I had a relatively brief flirtation with Christ, but it lasted for a few years there in my late adolescence and early adulthood. It was very formative for me, for sure. It certainly was a stepping stone into other versions of spirituality. So I can laugh about it on the one hand. In hindsight, it was a very naive religion in hindsight for me. But on the other hand, it was also a bridge into the spirituality that's been very sustaining across my lifetime. So that was the context of the next several years for me, like kind of emerging from my family was conservative Christianity. And lo and behold, I began to discover kind of the cracks in the sidewalk within Christianity, at least within the fundamentalist Christianity I was involved in. I still remember very well, I think I was just barely out of high school. There was a guest minister that came to our church and gave this sermon, and he was just rapidly going on and on about child sexual abuse in his sermon. And I can still remember, this would be a very pre-psychological Bob, I can still remember thinking, there's something that's happened to him that's coming through here. Methinks he doth protest way too much. And as it turned out, it wouldn't have had to go this way, but it did. It was only a short few months later that it was announced in all the local newspapers. I lived in such a small area that this kind of thing was front page paper stuff, is that he was indicted for, very sadly, for child sexual abuse himself. It was very, very sad to me. And it's less about relishing that than feeling like it was my second exposure to this dissonance between, on the one hand, in this case, spiritual language and practice, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, what appears to be very kind of unconscious sexual acting out. This on the heels of having grown up for decades in a family where there was all the political language and the rituals around that, on the one hand, and on the other hand, all kinds of unmetabolized grief and other psychological factors that manifested in terms of all kinds of behaviors, including abuse. But enough about my family and enough about Christianity. I soon enough began to be aware of how this was going on inside my own being, inside my own body, mind, and spirit. And first manifestations of this, which I again begin to see as shadow, whether it was my experience in Christianity or my experience in the politics of my family, I made some what seemed to be really poor or premature relationship choices, and I tended to do it habitually. And it manifested literally in a couple of failed marriages. One of them was a very long-term marriage, which my staying in it for as long as I did was probably another example of something that I was not conscious of, but that was dictating my behavior. And I came to see the templates or the blueprints for my relationship choices as being significantly informed by something that was out of my awareness and was in the shadows. I also noticed it as I moved into adulthood and into a career in clinical psychology that both in my teaching and in the therapy I did, I guess I'll add supervision to that as well, the work that I was doing, I tended to give more of myself than there is. So I got myself in and out of being pretty burned out and came to see this as a kind of accommodation that was linked to my relationship choices as well, where I would tend to, as one colleague of mine at one of the universities once said, he said, "Bob, you give away the gold." And tended to see that I gave away the gold, let's say, but did so with relative unself-awareness. And as this continued to manifest, then in terms of the fallout from poor relationship choices and the ways that I gave away my energy beyond my human capacity, this began to manifest then in my moving into addiction. And so the story of the last 15 years prior to my sobriety and recovery were pretty dictated by increasing addiction to alcohol and other drugs, excuse me. And which itself was a manifestation of the shadow, insofar as I was working as a clinical psychologist, and ironically and somewhat tragically, was working more and more with an addicted population. And so there I was, being the minister that I had seen all those years ago, who had so much to say about child sexual abuse, or in my family being so politically high-minded, there I was working with people that were themselves addicted as addiction crept in the back door. It was a very subtle thing for me. I talked to some here at Integral Recovery. My addiction to alcohol and drugs began late in middle life for me. It's just the way it worked, and it was really kind of a foot in the door, and it gradually opened to where within about 10 years I was really chemically dependent on both alcohol and prescription medication. So speaking of shadow. Now, simultaneous with all of this going on in my personal life and my reflecting on it, more unconsciously than consciously probably, I came to know two individuals, and they both had an influence on me that has borne fruit and that will bring us into our exercise today. First of all, I met Robert Bly, the poet Robert Bly. This was in the mid-80s. I had read his book, which I highly recommend to all of us. It's just called A Little Book on the Human Shadow. I used to require it in courses I taught in university, graduate students in psychology, and I would tell them this is one of the best books on psychology that I've ever read. In fact, I would share with them that most psychologists that I know, including myself, don't write very well. We're trained to write scientifically, but it doesn't make for very good reading. And Robert Bly, in the tradition of Freud and other really fine writers, was first of all an author, a poet, and secondly, was someone who reflected, I think, with considerable depth and empathy on the human shadow, including reflecting on his own shadow, which I found really important. So that little book, which I think is less than 100 pages, was a significant eye-opener, and I'll come back to it in just a moment. The second relationship that I formed that was really a friendship beginning back in the 80s as well was with the Jungian analyst Robert Johnson. we met at a conference on psychology and religion put on by the Quakers, and we immediately connected, and he was really a significant, I guess you'd say, father figure to me for the next several decades, really significant in my life, really owing to my own family background. Was really longing for an older male mentor, and here was somebody who I felt like really saw me, and I'm immensely grateful to Robert. Robert had gone to Switzerland in the 1940s and had come to know Jung, as well as Jung's prize student, Maria Luisa von Franz. And I remember Robert telling me that that von Franz would talk about the shadow in terms of that, first of all, you know, the shadow was really Jung's term, but when Franz said that the way that we work with the shadow is that we have to learn how to withdraw projections. And so the examples I gave earlier of projecting onto politics or religion or even onto therapy with addicts, that whatever is going on and whatever is animating the conversation, to withdraw that projection and look at it. And Robert taught me how to work with my dreams. And so I did dream work for the very first time, and it's been a sustained interest all these years. He also taught me the Jungian technique of active imagination, which I still utilize as well. Very, very helpful practices out of the Jungian tradition. A really good book, there are a number of good books on this. Robert's written a book on it. Just called Inner Work, and it's a really very easy to understand and very practical guide to both working with dreams and active imagination. And then secondly, kind of the classic in this field preceding Robert's book was by Barbara Hanna and her book on active imagination. She was a contemporary of Jung and Maria Luisa von Franz as well. Her book on active imagination is a real classic in the field, and I cannot remember the name of it right now, but if you look up Barbara Hanna with an H on the end under active imagination, you could find that book as well. They're both available in paperback, but Robert's book I have on my Kindle. You know, Robert Bly, in his book on the human shadow, talked about eating your own shadow. And as I spent more time with Robert in the context of a number of conferences, and this is at the kind of the height of the so-called men's movement in the 80s into the 90s with Robert Bly and James Hillman and Michael Mead and Robert Moore, Robert Bly taught me and taught us different ways of working with the shadow that were slightly different than what I'd learned from Robert Johnson out of the Jungian tradition. You know, Robert Bly was a poet and also very interested in ritual. And so I thought I'd died and gone to heaven the first conference I went to where Robert was leading it, because I got near the conference. It was up in Santa Barbara. Got out of my car and I heard drumming off in the distance. And I've been a lifelong drummer. So the idea of getting together and doing communal drumming and feeling like that has something to do with the shadow, I felt like I'd died and gone to heaven, really. It was honestly so pleasurable to me. I'm not sure much how much shadow work I got done, but I got a lot of good drumming done. But Robert put a lot of stake in various rituals, whether it would be journaling and writing your own poetry, drumming. We would dance, tell stories, and I found that also valuable as creating a foundation for working with the shadow for whenever I might be willing to start seriously working with a shadow because they hadn't begun yet. I mentioned one more comment about Robert Johnson. I mentioned that he'd had conversations with Jung back in the 40s, and Robert told me that Jung told him that shadow and projections, you remember?
We're losing you.
Von Franz.
I can't hear you. I think we just lost him.
Mm-hmm. There's always a hook for our projections.
Bob, excuse me.
Yes.
There was some sound like in a stairwell. We just lost what you said, the last few lines.
Okay. So if I back up to Robert Johnson and talking about Jung, is that far enough?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry about that. Robert Johnson, in conversation with Jung, was discussing the shadow, and Jung told him that there are always hooks for our projections. And when I asked Robert what was meant by that, he said that doing our internal work, because I'd already begun this and done this for a few years under Robert's kind of supervision and guidance, working with active imagination, doing a lot of inner work, is that Jung also said there are hooks for our projections. That is, there's the interpersonal dimension. And I realized that this was part of what I wasn't doing good work with. And that brings us to where I want to go today with bringing in forgiveness practice in terms of working with the shadow. And in the spirit of integral theory is that we don't miss any developmental lines, particularly the interpersonal developmental lines. I think what was going on for me is I was doing the beginnings of kind of upper left-hand quadrant work, individual interior spirituality and shadow work using dream work and active imagination. And I had been meditating with mindfulness practice for probably 10 years at this point. But what I wasn't addressing, and I felt a real gap in all of this, was the interpersonal dimension, which would be the lower left-hand quadrant, the plural or collective interior world. I did not much less work. I hadn't been involved in a spiritual community. I tried the Zen Center in Los Angeles. I'd gone to a silent, unprogrammed Quaker fellowship for about a year. Even tried the Catholic Church in kind of the more the monastic tradition. I couldn't find a community that fit for me for whatever reasons, and it left me really lacking, I think, in doing that lower left-hand quadrant work. And so this conversation with Robert spurred then further thought for me of how could I do this interior work, but work on the shadow in regards to relationships. I think it kind of stayed in the background for me. That question stayed with me. I intuited that it was at the bottom of what increasingly became a problem for me, namely my addictive behaviors. And I felt like that underneath that was a whole set of patterns that were set up in childhood for me, developing in my family of origin, of accommodating in order to be loved. And so whether it was in the work I did and overcommitting myself chronically, or it was in relationships I was in, basically doing the same thing, I felt like I needed to address shadow, and I needed to address it in some kind of interpersonal way because it felt like it was manifesting so much in the interpersonal domain for me. It was about 7 years ago that I began working on my recovery in earnest. There was an awareness that there was a problem and a lot of denial, and then that denial began to really break down. I started off by trying so-called harm reduction. So like if I could just cut back on my partying, that would be a good thing to do. And what I discovered over the next years, I was really serious about this, but it wasn't a good fit for me. It wasn't adequate. And so I wasn't good at moderation. And I've come to understand more recently over the last few years, last 5 years, why that's the case. I won't get into that right now. Suffice it to say that with my biology and my family's biology, I didn't start off from a place that I'd be well advised to consume substances like I did and I had done for years. And there's more to it than that. But what it led me to realize is that if I'm going to take this seriously, I'm going to really need to work an abstinence program. And that began 5 years ago. It's interesting how it works. I began working with a sponsor from AA, even though I didn't go to AA. This is another... It's just been a long road for me, you guys. I began working with Mick, who's got about 35 or 40 years of sobriety. He's a good Irishman. He's got some strongest Irish accent. And he lived the first half of his life in Ireland and has lived the rest of it here in Orange County. And I was recommended to him by somebody I worked with and began actually doing step work with Mick. But it wasn't until I really hit bottom because I was still not able to sustain sobriety. I hit bottom, went in the hospital for detox, and came out and began in earnest to get involved in a couple of different programs. I'll say more about both of those. But before I do that, the work I was doing with Mick, I continued over the next couple of years, including post-abstinence. In fact, it really began when I stopped any alcohol, stopped any drugs. And in particular, the pieces that brought to mind the shadow work and the questions I had had based on these conversations earlier in my life with people like Robert Bly and Robert Johnson, was it was steps 4 and 5 really felt like this is the work I've never done, which would be the moral inventory. And under my sponsor Mick's guidance, took an entire year to do that very lengthy process of moral inventory. Went into great depth. This included for me beginning to develop a sense of meditating in and around what was coming up in those stages, those steps. And I should say in that year solid of work, moved to the other steps as well, particularly steps 8 and 9 in terms of making amends. It felt like that the 4th and 5th steps and the 8th and 9th steps just dominated my landscape for a good year or two. Simultaneous then with my sponsoring work with Mick, I wasn't up for AA yet. I actually began going to AA about 6 months after the hospital. I got involved immediately, by good fortune, in hindsight, got involved immediately in the Los Angeles area with Noah Levine and his Against the Stream Fellowship, which is a Buddhist recovery approach. And read his books, Dharma Punks, and other books of his, and was really drawn to it. I think it was a good fit for me. I think as a lifelong musician and a kind of wild man, it felt like a good fit to be around people that had lots of tattoos and piercings. And so that I felt like those were my keeps. I got very involved in that, was involved in teaching there as well as participating, and the ritual of Against the Stream was, as it turns out, somewhat parallel to AA, but involved every week we'd get together, and it was a large group of people, between 75 and 100 people in a circle, where we would be practicing mindfulness meditation and then discussing what was coming up around that practice for ourselves, very much in the spirit of integral life practice. So there was for the first time, there was really a sense of practice being integrated with recovery. I began going to AA, and I was going to both at the same time, going to Against the Stream, the Buddhist Fellowship, once a week, sometimes twice a week, and going in several mornings a week to the AA Fellowship. And the two complemented each other, even though it wasn't a perfect fit for me. AA certainly wasn't a perfect fit for me. It was supported by my work in the Buddhist Recovery Network, and that really helped. It was during that time in Against the Stream that I went to trainings with Noah, and also with Kevin Griffin came and gave all-day workshops. And also in the L.A. area, a significant teacher of mine was George Haas. It was specifically George Haas's work around recovery practice from a Buddhist perspective, as applied to forgiveness practice, as applied to recovery. It was that work that really kind of added a final piece for me to the work I'd been doing for years, the active imagination work, journaling, and mindfulness. And now there was this forgiveness piece that was added. And I'll tell you this, and then we'll actually do an exercise now, is that the practice that I learned there with Noah Levine and George Haas particularly, it brought a deeper felt sense to me to all the 12-step work I had done. Even though I had done that with as much fidelity as I could muster, it was the forgiveness practice that added a new dimension of depth that has continued to inform me. Before we dive in, we're going to do like a 10-minute meditation, very kind of abbreviated meditation here, and I'd like invite you to join me. I'll talk us through it. This practice has really sustained me. I got a chance to present it at Against the Stream in our evening meetings, and so I'll be presenting it again to a group of 75 or 100 people, and it was wonderful then to be able to practice this together in a large group and then debrief about it. And so I want to give you just a little taste of what we would do there on Thursday evening in Santa Monica. And also to suggest that, for what it's worth, I think it's important for me to tell you, is that this practice is a part of my my morning meditations every morning. I do this, and it's infinitely creative because whoever you choose to focus on is different every day. And so I'm grateful for it, and I present it in the context of integral life practice as something that you might consider, adapt yourself, or maybe already have. So why don't we begin? Let's get ourselves comfortable, and I'll give you just a little entree here. When I get up in the morning, my ritual is I get up and drag myself to the gym, and I work out. I tend to do better with meditation if I'm awake, and so it's very hard for me to go right into meditation and quiet time in the morning. So I work out for an hour. I do aerobic and a little light weight lifting and so on. And then I'm pretty awake. And then I typically, because it's Southern California, I go outside and sit outside quietly where I can just be out as the sun is kind of coming up and birds are tweeting and so on. And I have privacy that way, which I'm fortunate for. And I move into meditation. And the way that goes for me is minutes. I meditate for just 20 minutes, sometimes a half hour. It's typically about 20 minutes. I spend about 5 minutes just practicing mindfulness of the breathing, and I do something called sensory practice, kind of go through different systems in my body just to kind of settle in. And then I spend about 5 minutes in what is traditionally called mindfulness practice, which is just being with my breathing and watching thoughts as they cross across the mental landscape. And then I move into forgiveness practice. My forgiveness practice actually takes 5 minutes or so. It's very kind of ritualized. And then I'll spend 5 minutes wrapping up the meditation in what's called metta practice or loving kindness, where I'll send prayers out to people in my life, my day, and also gratitude, express gratitude for so many different things in my life. And that's what I do every morning. And I think it keeps the system relatively cleaned out. So it's in that spirit then. So if I was doing this, I would have spent already 10 minutes or so getting centered. I think it's really important to do that. We won't have time to do that today, but whatever you do to get centered with John's entrainment tapes, with whatever practice you use, to get yourself into a place that's open. And then we actually move into the mindfulness practice. I'm going to talk us through this, but I'm going to leave some space for you to apply it, if you're willing, to your own self. And I'm not going to ask you to share at all what you experience unless you care to at the end. Oftentimes it has different versions, but oftentimes what I'll do is I'll focus on a relationship that's current for me, or sometimes it's in the distant past even. But I'll focus on a relationship where I feel like that I want to make amends. And the practice goes like this, and this is follows very much the format I learned from George Haas in Against the Stream. I bring that person into my awareness, and so why don't you just think for a second of somebody you can bring into your awareness that you'd like to ask forgiveness from. I'm here in Las Vegas, and my mother lives about an hour due west of where I am in my hotel. And it is she who I'm going to select to work with this morning. So when you have somebody in mind, the practice is very simple. There's just 9 different statements you make, just 9. And they're in groups of 3, so there's really just 3 different conversations that you have. And it goes like this. and ask you to join me in this privately. For whatever I have done to you, in my case, it's my mom. Think of whoever it is for you. For whatever I have done to you, or not done for you, causing you harm, please forgive me. By the way, you don't have to write this down. I'm gonna send the format out to Heidi and have her distribute it to all of us, so you don't have to write anything down here. So one more time. For whatever I have done to you or not done for you, causing you harm, please forgive me. So think of what it is that you've done or not done. Specifically, address this person in your mind's eye with sincerity and ask for their forgiveness. Next, for whatever I have said to you or said against you, causing you harm, please forgive me. Just feel down into that. Third, for whatever I have thought about you or thought against you, causing you harm, please forgive me. Okay, the next three all hang together, and these represent a change of perspective. You'll see it immediately. Same person, a dialogue with this person in your mind's eye. And here you say to yourself, for whatever you have done to me or not done for me, causing me harm, I forgive you. Next, for whatever you have said to me or said against me, causing me harm, I forgive you. Next, for whatever you have thought about me or thought against me, causing me harm, I forgive you.
Hi, good morning.
Excuse me for just a second. Half hour?
That's fine, perfect time. Thank you.
Sorry about that. Life intervenes. For whatever you have thought about me or thought against me, causing me harm, I forgive you. And then the final three all go together as well. For whatever I have done to you or not done for you, causing you harm, I forgive myself. Then, for whatever I have said to you or set against you, causing you harm, I forgive myself. And finally, for whatever I have thought about you or thought against you, causing you harm, I forgive myself. Okay. That's the practice. As I mentioned earlier, I generally move directly into metta practice or loving kindness, as it's translated, where I will often, most often, will pray for that individual. And it's I'm not going to do it right now, so much as I'll just share. I'll pray that they might know. That they might feel. I frame it in terms of God's love. You could find whatever language you're comfortable with. I pray that they would feel God's love, and I actually pray that God will feel their love as well. And then I move from that to, may they feel God's peace. May God feel their peace, and may they feel God's joy. And may God feel their joy. I mention that right now because it's a significant integration for me that is really effective. If I've done this forgiveness practice with some attentiveness and some sincerity, it really is satisfying then to move into imagining that person experiencing love and peace and joy and actually emanating that. So that's it. That's the practice. one last word, and then I'd like to just talk about it together, your experience, your thoughts, your own practice, and so on, is that how this pertains to shadow. It's interesting. During the meditation, it actually came up as a distraction for me, as things can. Is that, how are you going to tie this into how are you going to tie this into shadow, Bob? Is that I can tell you the experience for me is that in doing this work, there's such reconciliation inside. It's manifest outside for me with these people, including my mom, very significantly troubled relationship over most of my adulthood. And it's been really healing these last few years of my being earnest about my own recovery. And I believe that this forgiveness practice, she's a frequent visitor to my meditations, that it's transformed something inside, but also in the spirit of Jung's comment about a projection having a hook to hang on to in the interpersonal, is that it's healing of the relationship for me. It's not just an interior phenomenon. It's actually manifested. In the case of my mom, it's manifested in action. My father, who just passed away a couple of years ago, there's been much work similarly with him. There's been so much healing, even though it's not literally in the physical realm, so much healing that's been afforded by this practice. And on it goes. Most often my meditations are around my primary relationship to Colleen and to my relationship to my daughter Amanda, because they're such central figures in my daily economy. And so they're just often a part of this practice, and it really feels like it's a way for me to dig into shadow elements, things that I've said, done, not done, et cetera, and to move it into a place where there's real traction for me in the relational domain. So I offer it to you in that spirit. I hope that it's suggestive and supportive of your own work. And I really want to invite for the next 10, 15 minutes, any thoughts, conversation, questions, oppositions, whatever. Okay, so we're open now.
Yeah, hi, Bob. It's Lisa and everybody.
Hi, Lisa. Hi, Lisa.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that. One of the things I notice about that practice is it helps me to address that issue on the psychological level and deal with forgiveness on the psychological level as opposed to transcending it in the non-dual space, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, yeah.
But what I would also say about that is, I'll try to keep this really short. What I noticed in my own practice working with shadow, where I actually do work through working with the projection and reeling it back in, is there is a space beyond this thing we call forgiveness that is the absence of blame, where no forgiveness is required. I'm not suggesting that it's of more value or of less value or that it's a belief system, but what I know is having experienced it from questioning all of my resentments towards someone who had quote-unquote harmed me and finding out that it never happened.
Yeah. I love what you're saying. In fact, I'm glad that you're saying it because I wouldn't even think to say it, but what you just described is how this practice has evolved for me, and it's how it goes for me.
Awesome.
In fact, thank you for naming it, because I would have just glided right by that, is that I just experienced it right now, so I don't have to get all theoretical, and I know you're certainly not being theoretical, is that when I'm working with my mom right now in this practice, is that what forgiveness is absolutely synonymous with is no blame.
It's even, there's no forgiveness required. What I noticed is forgiveness and blame are sort of one and the same thing. They kind of require each other. If I think I need to forgive you, I still blame you. There's nothing wrong with that. At the psychological level, a man raped me in a parking lot. But when I questioned my projections about that event on the transpersonal level, I fell into a space where not only did I not blame him anymore, he was my honored teacher. And I literally fell apart in love. And so that sounds really radical, but I know what I'm talking about. It's like there's a space beyond that where there's no need to forgive them. They never harmed me. They came to serve me. And the danger of that is to turn that into a belief system and skip the work that needs to be done. So I'm not suggesting that. I'm not suggesting anybody should ever experience that in a rape situation. It's a very heated subject. So I just want to caveat that that was just my experience.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to look it up. It's going to distract me from being present with you. I tell you who writes about this in a way that's been really meaningful to me, and I've never connected it to right now because the practice is the practice for me, and it leads to this conclusion for me. I feel very much akin with you around your experience of working in and around the rape situation, is that you can't possibly say that to a lot of people because it's so offensive, but it is absolutely my experience with some of the most heinous things that have happened to me and that I've perpetrated in my life. Who's written about this that I find really helpful is Eckhart Tolle. His writings about forgiveness is that when he discusses forgiveness, that's I wish I could find his exact quotes, but you're familiar enough to know, is that he says, if forgiveness is real, then it's not necessary. In other words, forgiveness—that is what forgiveness is—is that it kind of dissolves in on itself, and that's exactly my experience. So for most people, when they think of forgiveness at an ego level, I'm going to forgive you for having harmed me.
At this
other level that we're talking about, there's no I versus you. There's no other, and there's only compassion because you can only understand. From this perspective, you can understand how and why that happened, and it's very hard to beat up on somebody when you realize with compassion how it is that this came to be.
And what was so interesting about that experience, I'll just share real quickly, that was so magical was within a month I found myself in a situation in a prison working with addicted prisoners, one of them a rapist, and he wrote down his beliefs about his crime, and I wrote down my beliefs about my experience, and we facilitated each other on that, and it was like so beyond anything I've ever experienced, where we just ended up laughing, like just laughing, and tears running down our faces, because we had the same mind. You know, there just was no criminal and no crime and no victim, and it was just extraordinary. So it attracted that, you know, being able to have that experience just attracted this amazing healing. So would I call being raped a tragedy in my life? No, it was the greatest gift ever given to me. But again, like I said, like you said, you're careful how you share that, because some people can be hurt by that. Thinking that I'm saying that's a should. It's just what my experience was. Very awesome.
Yeah. I want to share with you, in the spirit of all that you're saying, and I really appreciate all that you're saying, Lisa. It's inspiring, and I feel like I'm right with you. Eckhart Tolle says in The Power of Now, he says, forgiveness is to relinquish your grievance, and so to let go. It's to relinquish your grievance. He says it's to offer no resistance to life, to allow life to live through you. And he contrasts that with non-forgiveness, which would be kind of the earlier step that you and I are talking about, is that he says non-forgiveness, where you're to blame and now I've got to forgive you and it's really hard fucking work and all of that. Non-forgiveness is the very nature of the mind. He says that's what the mind does. It cannot survive without that. He says the mind cannot forgive.
Yes. And I think it really relates to shadow work, in that talk about a reclamation project to pull back our projections onto people and discover a disowned level of love we never even imagined was in us. Like, the shadow is not always dark, is it?
No, you just put your finger right on it, Lisa. That's been exactly the experience for me. It's what it's done to open up. You know, I talked earlier about this idea of projections and withdrawing them and a hook to hang a projection on and so on. When that is really dissolved, as I mentioned, when that really drops through the floor, it's extraordinary what opens up. And to find some way to cultivate this, open up a space for this on a daily basis, has been absolutely transformative. I think it's been the most meaningful aspect of the 12-step work for me, as it continues, because it continues, now it continues every day because of this work. Certainly the most meaningful addition to my mindfulness practice in just the last 5 years. I've practiced mindfulness for 35 years now. This piece has just completely opened it up for me, even as I continue to surround it. It's embedded mindfulness practice, but I'm really grateful for this. Let me open it up to others. Sally, Victoria, any thoughts, any comments?
Well, this is Victoria, and one of the thoughts that's coming to me as I listen particularly to the two of you, Lisa and Bob, and what you've just said, is how my experience exists on different levels. And so there are those times when I am in a deep place that I experience exactly what you're talking about. My work today was with my daughter, and that's a relationship that gets thorny at times. And I see her frequently, so often when I see her, I'm not in that place where I have that much more comprehensive perspective. And so I find I was really touched by the practice you gave us, Bob, because
that sort of
took my experience with her to a different level. And I've done so much work with that already.
Yeah,
but
just
helpful to know that we can practice this at different levels, and at levels that are appropriate in any given time.
You know, Victoria, thank you, Victoria, and I appreciate your openness and your kind comments. I've drummed for 50 years, and I'm still learning new rhythms. Here I am in Las Vegas listening last night to some jazz rhythms, working out these new rhythms. And some of this stuff is so challenging and awkward. Sometimes it'll take me 5 years to actually be able to even conceptualize a rhythm, much less begin to get it in my body and be able to execute, to perform the rhythm. And that's an analogy for me to this practice, because it can be so challenging, especially in the most important relationships, especially when you're dealing with it day in, day out, as you are with your daughter, to begin to develop this other voice, this other platform for a relationship. And it doesn't happen quickly, but it does over time, at least in my experience, Victoria, it does begin to it begins to kind of rise up as a more and more dominant companion voice in those relationships. I still get activated in the most intimate relationships for me, but what's incredible for me is to see that it's not just that, is that I can recover from that more quickly now, and I really ascribe that to, among other things, this practice, as well as that there's more of a buffer. So let's say that I drive an hour west of here to visit with my mom. There are so many things that can be provocative in my relationship with my mom to this mm-hmm. day. But I've got a different, I've got a slight leg up owing to this practice, because it's my relationship with my mom is cultivated or founded more and more on compassion inside. So I'm going to be just that little bit less reactive. And if I do react, move into some kind of complex, let's say, with my mom, I do know that I do notice that I'm much quicker to recover, and I'm really grateful for that. That feels like such an incredible grace after a lifetime of really problematic relationships, including with her. Yeah. So
yes,
the practice
very
does
much,
make a difference.
Yeah, I very much hear that, and that has been my experience as well, that I am able even internally to catch that shadow as it arises and not go there. So, yes, definitely.
Yeah, it's encouraging. That's great to hear. Thank you, Victoria. Sally, any thoughts from you?
Yeah, lots of thoughts going on here, even when I wasn't meant to be thinking them during the meditation. Yeah, can you just tell me, Bob, how much more time we have? Is this an hour call or?
Yeah, we have a couple more minutes. Is that right, Heidi?
Yes, only about two more minutes.
About two more minutes. So
I wonder.
Okay, well, I'll keep it short.
Sally, also what we can do is on Friday when we meet, if the gang is agreeable, we could follow up and amplify this as it kind of resonates through. So I'm very open to doing that. Heidi, you can help with that in terms of that it's going to work this Friday. But I'd be
yes, I'd love to do that. I was just going to suggest that. But Sally, let's hear from you for just a minute.
Yes.
Okay. Quite probably rather unformed ideas here, but I'm just noticing sort of feelings and felt senses in my body as we did that, and it was definitely there's some resistance there, and I think some of it is to the word itself, forgiveness, which I think for me probably has, you know, some Christian connotations, and no offense there, but you know, a sort of, there's quite a lot of conditioning around the word, and I don't know what the etymology of the word forgiveness is, but it suggests to me perhaps a sort of, I can give you something, and that I feel uncomfortable with that, and I think that's what Lisa was touching on. I'd really like to discuss it a bit further and think, reflect on it a bit more.
I'd love to do that. I just a real quick word is that owing to my background, which is fairly traumatic in nature in Christianity, I've had such a reaction to language that most people don't find at all unpleasant or certainly activating. AA and the 12-step movement is so rife with Christian language in my experience that it's a challenge to move through that. So I'd be some hypocrite not to really honor your own reactivity to that word. And then secondly, it helped me a lot to have it couched within a Buddhist metaphysic, within a Buddhist approach. And so for whatever reason, it's transferred from my earlier Christian roots, which are fundamentalist in nature and not at all really consistent with where I am these days, to a Buddhist cosmology and a Buddhist ethic, which is really without any offense to me at all. So I don't know if we can find a different word. I'm sure that there's a word in Sanskrit or Pali that would be useful just because it's neutral. And so I don't care what we call it. And I totally get your reaction to it. I really want you to know that. I'm glad you mentioned it because words matter. You know, they really do matter.
Yeah, and I did. Yeah, I don't want to overplay it. I just wanted to put out that was my response to it.
When you said what you said, I looked up forgiveness. I did a Google search for forgiveness in the background, and on the first page, every reference is to Bible verses about forgiveness. Forgiveness in the Bible, how to forgive in the 12 steps. It's just daily inspiration. It's all, you know, there you have it. So say no more. let's come up with a groovy integral alternative. Let's do that, you guys, okay? I know we have to stop for today, and if we can have this just be part one, and if you all can reconvene on Friday, I would love that. And let's follow up on this last comment that you made, Sally. I'd love to expand more on what you've learned, which is a lot. Lisa, I really appreciate you sharing what you shared, and I'd love to talk more about that if you care to. And you too, Victoria. So let's do follow up on Friday. And Heidi, I want you to be able to chime in on Friday too, okay?
Good. I'd love to. And also, I was thinking it might be fun to do that exercise again, you know, at the beginning on Friday, and then have the whole hour to talk about stuff like
that. Great idea.
That sounds good. Why don't we start with that on Friday? That's a great idea, Heidi.
Good.
And we'll take it from there.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Many blessings to all of you. Wish you well.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye-bye. Take care. We'll see you on Friday.
Thank you, Bob.
Okay. You're welcome. You're very welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.